Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California and tonight's program, How Tiananmen Changed China, with John Kam. He's the founder and executive director of the Dui Hua Foundation. My name is Cynthia Miyashita. I serve as the chairman of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum. I'd also like to thank the Asia Society of Northern California for their support of tonight's program. At this time, it gives me pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, John Kam. I'm going to do so by reading a few excerpts from a magazine article in the New York Times published a few years ago. Almost no one seemed less likely to become a crusader for human rights than John Kam. He was the president of Hong Kong's American Chamber of Commerce and a regional vice president of Occidental Chemical Corporation, a multinational corporation that paid Kam, according to the article, very handsomely, provided him with a luxury apartment, a Mercedes, a driver, two maids, cost of living allowance, private school tuition for his sons, and paid home leave. He had very few reasons to rock the boat. But in May 1990, a week before Kam's trip to Washington to testify before Congress that China's human rights record should not get in the way of granting the country most favored nation trade status, Zhao Nan, Beijing's senior representative in Hong Kong, held a banquet to thank the American business community and proposed a toast to John Kam. As Kam explained it, an idea popped into his head at that moment. He had read that morning in the South China Morning Post about a young student from Hong Kong who had been detained in Shanghai shortly after the Tiananmen massacre and was being tortured in prison. Kam knew that Congress would inevitably raise Tiananmen as the main reason the country should get no favors from Washington, and he also knew that gestures by China would help ease tensions. So in the midst of his toast, Kam turned to Zhao and said, "Why don't you release Yao Yangshan?" His host Zhao became immediately hostile, and when Kam left the room, his fellow American businessmen apologized to Zhao. Roughly a month later, though, Yao Yangshan walked out of prison. A little over a year later, Kam resigned from Occidental to form his own company so that he could devote more time to working on prisoners' rights issues in China. He now works full-time in this effort through Dui Hua Foundation, which he founded. In recognition of its human rights advocacy and expertise, the foundation was granted special consultative status by the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations in 2005. Kam estimates that his involvement has been at least partly responsible for about 250 prisoners being released or being given better treatment in prison. In the words of the New York Times, no other person or organization in the world, including the State Department, has helped more Chinese prisoners. Would you please welcome John Kam?
Thank you very much, Cynthia, and thank you all for coming here this evening. 20 years ago, at this hour, a long line of tanks began moving out of Tiananmen Square, heading east along Chang'anjie, the Street of Heavenly Peace. And as they made their way east along Chang'anjie, a young man, whose name we do not know, dressed in a white shirt and black trousers and carrying a satchel, positioned himself in front of the lead tank. I'd like you all to join me in a moment of silence for all those who died for what they believe in 20 years ago. Thank you. In the book of Laughter and forgetting, Milan Kundera tells the story of an official who falls from power in communist Czechoslovakia. He is executed and airbrushed from history. But because he gave his hat to another official on stage with him, his hat was not airbrushed from history. Whenever people saw the hat, they remembered the man. Kundera gives voice to the hope of those who would erase history and those who would remember it when he wrote, "Before long, the nation will forget what it is and what it was. The world around it will forget even faster. But the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting." By that measure, the struggle that began in Tiananmen Square 20 years ago continues today. It lives in memory and in legacy. It gave birth to an era of protest and the rise of human rights consciousness among the Chinese people. For the first time in history, a Chinese government faced massive international criticism for its human rights record. Pressure from abroad and rising dissent at home have together helped bring about significant developments in the area of human rights in China, though much work needs to be done. During the last 2 weeks, there have been an outpouring of memories of June 4th. We have heard from virtually all the June 4th protest leaders, including Bao Tong, Wang Dan, Chai Ling, Wu Arkaishi, as well as many more lesser-known dissidents who went to prison for what they did in the square and in hundreds of cities across the country. Prisoners in Zhejiang, for instance, have eloquently spelled out what it means to be released from prison and branded as a June 4th prisoner. In their words, "We are simply waiting to die." The New York Times on Sunday devoted an entire page to remembrances of June 4th by four Chinese artists. Ma Jian, the author of Beijing Coma, has written a particularly moving testimony of what he went through in June of 1989. I commend it to you. Ding Zilin and the Tiananmen mothers, those who lost children in the suppression of the protests, have released another in a series of calls for the government to take responsibility for the large number of civilian deaths in Beijing. In Hong Kong, the only place administered by China, where June 4th is still remembered publicly, a huge candlelight vigil is set to begin in a few hours. Hong Kong University students have recently overwhelmingly condemned the killings and the subsequent repression, even voting out the president of the student body for attempting to take a softer line on Tiananmen. Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule 12 years ago, but the memory of Tiananmen lives on. Striking from the grave, ousted party secretary Zhao Ziyang has provided fresh and vivid reporting in his recently published memoirs of how the crackdown against protesters came about. His book is flying off the shelves in Hong Kong and is doubtless already available in some form or another inside China itself. After years of seeming apathy among Chinese students, there are signs, in fact, that China's youth are taking more interest in what happened on June 4th. In a recent article in Hong Kong South China Morning Post, the story is told of a lecture by an 83-year-old professor by the name of Zhang Sizhi to a rapt audience of 300 students at the China University of Political Science and Law in Beijing. Professor Zhang, who is also a criminal defense lawyer, spoke openly of his work defending June 4th dissidents, including Wang Juntao and Bao Tung, and he admonished the students to face truth and history with courage. While the professor spoke, security agents hovered around the perimeter, but they never actually intervened to stop the lecture. In fact, there have been small, tiny signs that Beijing is willing to allow a little more leeway in discussion of June 4th. Private memorial services have been held with the knowledge of police. A proxy for the government has written an op-ed for CNN in which it is acknowledged that mistakes were made. Mention has been made of June 4th in an official newspaper, the Global Times. Now, Chinese police have reacted in familiar fashion to those identified as troublemakers in the run-up to the 20th anniversary, hustling dissidents out of town, detaining them for brief periods, or inviting them to drink tea, which is a euphemism for a mild form of interrogation, always cutting off their access to outsiders. Yet so far, Beijing has shown relative restraint, at least when compared to the past. Interference with media, extending to shutdowns of Twitter, Flickr, Hotmail, and numerous websites is intensifying, and monitoring of emails is at an all-time high. But the days when the Chinese government can effectively control the access of its citizens to information and opinions not sanctioned by the state, these days are coming to an end. As China's citizens become wealthier and have more time to debate and ask questions, travel more, and enjoy more ways of finding out information, interest in what happened 20 years ago will grow, not subside. China has produced many of the world's greatest historians, but the history of Tiananmen is yet to be written. Tiananmen lives on in memory, but it also lives on in legacy. What happened in Tiananmen Square 20 years ago changed China in big, but as yet undetermined ways. When asked more than 50 years ago for his assessment of the French Revolution, Zhou Enlai famously replied that it was too early to say. We should bear this wisdom in mind as we seek to understand how China has changed and is changing because of Tiananmen. In trying to assess how Tiananmen changed China, we not only lack the benefit of time, for after all, 20 years in the sweep of Chinese history is not a long time, but we also lack key information on the events in Beijing and the subsequent uprisings all over the country. Vitally important questions remain to be answered before history is written and verdicts are passed. What was the decision process whereby martial law was declared? Zhao Ziyang says that the decision to send in the troops violated party procedures. Was martial law itself legally declared? In terms of operational responsibility, which units did what under whose command? What is so striking to me as someone whose human rights career spans the entire 20 years since Tiananmen is that we still don't know the answers to critical questions such as these. How many died in the massacre? The Chinese government has released a figure of 241 dead and 7,000 wounded. I tend to go with Nicholas Kristof's estimate of 800 deaths in Beijing. Kristof won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the 1989 protests and visited hospitals the day afterwards. It is increasingly accepted that students were not shot in the square itself. The majority of deaths, all of the deaths occurred throughout the city as enraged citizens took up arms and fought with the soldiers. How many people were executed? In Beijing, we know of 12 executions shortly after Tiananmen. There were also executions in the provinces, but all told, probably fewer than 100 people were executed. How many were detained? The Duihua Foundation keeps track of statistics on so-called political cases discovered and solved by China's political police. That's the first bureau of the Ministry of Public Security. We have found statistics on political cases in areas covering approximately 11% of China's population. Extrapolating from this data, we estimate that approximately 13,500 political cases took place in China in 1989, of which about 10,000 were solved. Now, these statistics are provided for a place, how many political cases were discovered, how many were solved. That's how the police do it. If we subtract cases in 1989, not related to June 4th, and we assume 2 individuals per political case, we arrive at an estimate of at least 15,000 people detained in political cases arising from June 4th. It is possible that not all instances of rioting were classified as political cases, so the number of people detained after June 4th could be much higher. Whatever it is, the number is staggeringly high. Duihua maintains a database on individuals arrested in political cases since 1980. We have about 17,000 records in the database. Of those, 2,125 individuals detained for their activities during June 4th have been put in the database. And we add names all the time. We find names all the time. Recently, a Chinese NGO released a report with new names of people detained. Based on this report, we will add between 100 and 200 names to the database. But we still probably know fewer than 15% of the names of people detained. How many places were affected by the protests? This is where it really gets difficult. I was in southern China on June 4th, 1989, within range of Hong Kong TV, which broadcast footage of the suppression of the protests. I would hazard a guess that every township of any size in the Pearl River Delta witnessed protests in the aftermath of the bloodshed. The number of places affected by protests certainly exceeds 1,000 nationwide. We estimate that about a quarter of political cases from June 4th went unsolved, a percentage which is much higher than the usual 90% solution rate for political crime. Like today, China's police simply cannot and could not cope with the number and intensity of protests. As with our work uncovering the names of those detained, Duihua records accounts of local protests in China's police records. Recently, we discovered a detailed account of what happened in Kunming, which is the capital of Yunnan province. According to this account, the city witnessed protests that began in April and lasted for nearly a week after June 4th. Marches before the killings already exceeded 30,000 participants. Citizen organizations arose to manage the protests. According to official statistics, there were 68 incidents of industrial unrest, 130 street protests, and 51 hunger strikes. 17 cases of counter-revolution were solved. A total of 61 individuals were detained, of whom 25 were formally arrested and brought to trial. 16 sent to re-education through labor camps, and 20 handled through other methods. This in a city of about 2 million people. Despite the difficulties in assessing how Tiananmen changed China, I would like to offer three observations on how the 1989 protests and their suppression impacted the Chinese government and the Chinese people. Excuse me. So, three observations. First, Tiananmen delayed economic reform and economic growth by at least 3 years, probably more. It took Deng Xiaoping's Southern Tour of 1992 to affirm the export-driven, wealth-generating model developed for China's development by the purged Zhao Ziyang. Wherever China is today economically, it could have gotten there sooner and with much less sacrifice had Tiananmen not taken place. Tiananmen also stifled legal reform. Perhaps the best example is the removal of counter-revolution as a crime from the criminal law. It was well on track to be removed in 1988. However, Tiananmen, labeled a counter-revolutionary riot, put paid to that idea. It wasn't until 1997 that China removed counter-revolution from its criminal code. At that time, there were just under 2,000 counter-revolutionaries in prison under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Justice. Today, 12 years later, there are still more than 100 counter-revolutionaries in prison, including several convicted of counter-revolutionary sabotage during the June 4th protests. Their continued incarceration has affected China's ability to ratify the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Another area where Tiananmen might have affected legal form is with regard to the death penalty. Unfortunately, we have too little data on the number of executions in China to draw firm conclusions. The only county in China for which we have found detailed statistics on executions is Maguan County in Yunnan Province. These numbers do show a very big increase in the number of executions in 1989 and thereafter. Now, China has recently made great strides in reducing the number of executions nationwide. From about 15,000 a year a decade ago to about 5,000 today in 2008. What strikes me, though, about this, other than the sheer numbers involved, is that it took over a decade after Tiananmen until serious reductions in the use of capital punishment took place. That's my first observation. The second observation is that Tiananmen ushered in the era of mass protests in China, and it gave rise to a greater human rights consciousness on the part of the Chinese people. The Chinese government has, since Tiananmen, had to contend with mounting protests covering a wide range of grievances, including some of the very grievances, many economic, that led to the 1989 protests. Duihua keeps track of mass incidents in a database that currently holds information on nearly 1,400 incidents over the last 3 years, a small fraction of the total. Not only are protests erupting every day somewhere in China, the vast majority of these protests, so-called mass incidents, are nonviolent. They're peaceful expressions of discontent. And more often than not, they are resolved without recourse to violence. When violence takes place and offenders are sentenced by courts, the sentences are far less harsh than those imposed on the 1989 protesters. China's police are more sophisticated and less heavy-handed in dealing with mass incidents today than they were in 1989, and to some extent this appears to be the case with dissent by intellectuals as well. Witness the relatively lenient treatment of Charter 08 drafters. This is the document calling for democracy and human rights that was released in December and attracted something like 8,000 signatures before the police shut down the website. Now, I want to be clear about this. The exception to this lighter touch is in Tibet and Xinjiang. In these autonomous regions and in other areas of the Tibetan plateau, a severe crackdown is underway. In 2008, there were more than 1,600 arrests for the most serious political crime, endangering state security nationwide in China, more than double the number recorded in 2007. Large-scale arrests and protests classified as endangering state security have taken place in Tibetan areas and in Xinjiang, accounting for well over 50% of all ESS, endangering state security arrests. That's my second observation then. Third, for the first time in Chinese history, a Chinese government has had to contend with an outpouring of negative international public opinion after the suppression of the 1989 protests. Perhaps the best illustration of what has happened to China's image after Tiananmen can be found in the Gallup poll annual survey of American opinion on different foreign countries. Before Tiananmen, and we forget this today, before Tiananmen, China was viewed favorably by over 70% of the American people. After Tiananmen, that was cut in half. Only half that number had a favorable impression of China in late 1989. Although there has been movement up and down over the years, the percentage of American people who view China favorably has never exceeded 50% again. And today, in the most recent poll, it stands at 41%. I am very concerned by data that suggests that China's unpopularity has metastasized in the United States. Three separate polls released this year have a majority of Americans holding negative views of China. Of course, it was not only American public opinion that was badly affected by Tiananmen. Opinion elsewhere in the world was equally negative. The EU imposed an arms embargo that it has to this day refused to lift because of Tiananmen. As in North America, there is little to suggest that opinion towards China has changed in European countries and in other democracies. A BBC poll taken in January this year shows a sharp drop in China's popularity over the last 12 months, which is really quite astonishing when you consider the success of the Olympics, the positive publicity on its economic performance, putting a man in space, et cetera, et cetera. How can it be that China's public image has been hurt so badly over the last 12 months? Obviously, little to do with Tiananmen, but lots to do with human rights. In part, to counter the bad image that arose after Tiananmen, the Chinese government has, in a sense, discovered human rights. To my way of thinking, this is one of the most significant changes originating from what happened in Tiananmen 20 years ago. China now takes into account what the world thinks of it. Not as much as the world might want, but far more than any other period, certainly within the life of the People's Republic. Chairman Mao didn't care what foreigners thought about him or China. And he presided over horrors far worse than Tiananmen. So consider then what China has done in the area of human rights policy and diplomacy since 1989. First, it has sharply reduced the number of executions, which is a development especially popular in Europe. it has passed a new labor law that increases protection for workers. It has reduced the use of re-education through labor from more than 300,000 inmates in these camps 5 years ago to about half that number today. But they have yet to abolish this form of arbitrary detention, though they have promised fundamental reforms. China has established a network of human rights dialogues and exchanges with more than 20 countries. It has held talks on normalization of relations with the Vatican. It has had 7 or 8 sessions of dialogue with the Tibetans. It has hosted UN rapporteurs and has taken a leadership role in the United Nations Human Rights Council. It has published a human rights national plan, a national action plan. It has signed, though not yet ratified, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And finally, it has released and reduced the sentences of hundreds of political prisoners presented on lists to the Chinese government. It should be remembered that prior to Tiananmen, the Chinese government had never released a political prisoner as a result of international diplomacy, public or private. In the years since Tiananmen, the practice has become commonplace. I myself have been involved in hundreds of what I call transactions in this area. Polling data suggests that China's image improves when prisoners are released. In my opinion, China's international image could benefit from a large-scale special pardon on the occasion of the 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, which falls on October 1st this year. I think you know that in Chinese traditional culture, 60 is the most important anniversary. It represents the full cycle of the traditional calendar. In ancient China, emperors often declared amnesties on their birthday. On the 10th anniversary of China's founding in 1959, a special pardon was issued, covering roughly 80,000 prisoners. This proposal for a special pardon is being vigorously debated in China. And I am told that some senior leaders have shown an interest in it. But it is too early to say if Beijing will, in fact, issue a 60th anniversary special pardon. And if it does, who will benefit? What took place 20 years ago in China not only changed China, it also changed the world. It presaged the fall of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Governments there, faced with mass protests, decided against using force, in part because of the widespread revulsion felt after what happened in Tiananmen. Tiananmen also, and this is of interest to those who live here, Tiananmen fueled the rise to power of a San Franciscan congresswoman who led the fight against the renewal of China's most favored nation status in Congress. She was elected, as you probably know, in a special election in 87 and was actually a first-term congresswoman when Tiananmen happened. Had she succeeded in imposing conditions that the Chinese government refused to meet, China would have lost access to the U.S. market. It is no exaggeration to say that had this happened, there would have been no Chinese economic miracle. Tiananmen ushered in the era of cable news, a fledgling network by the name of CNN covered the protests live and gave us pictures which remain vivid in the memory of the world, including, of course, that picture of a man facing down a tank, a man whose name we do not know. And, of course, Tiananmen changed my life forever. 20 years ago, as Cynthia has related, I was a successful businessman. I was a business leader in Hong Kong. Today, I run the Dui Hua Foundation in San Francisco, a group promoting respect for human rights in China and the United States. My first intervention in May 1990 was on behalf of a Tiananmen prisoner. The last release Dui Hua announced was for a June 4th hooligan, maybe the last person convicted of hooliganism for his involvement in the protests. We announced his release a couple of weeks ago. Hooliganism as a crime, very poorly defined crime, was also removed from China's criminal code in 1997. In all, I have asked the Chinese government about more than 250 prisoners convicted of June 4th related offenses. The great majority have been released and before the end of their term. Dui Hua estimates that there are about 30 people still in prison for offenses committed on or around June 4th, 1989. They are now mostly middle-aged men who were once young workers swept up in a tide of anger and destruction. Youngsters like Wang Jun in Xi'an, who at 18 was sentenced to death, suspended for 2 years, and ultimately commuted for burning two police motorcycles and stealing a policeman's calculator. All of those who remain in prison, like Wang Jun, he has 2 years to serve, all of them have received sentence reductions for good behavior. They have all served more than half of their sentences. They are all eligible for parole. Several are serving sentences for crimes that were removed from the criminal law a dozen years ago. They no longer represent a threat to society. When I first pleaded for the release of a prisoner at a business dinner with Mr. Jonan in May 1990, I fumbled to express sentiments not completely formed, even in my own mind. I had no idea I would ask for the release of this young man. As I struggled to find the words that I needed to convince the Chinese official to consider my request, I found myself quoting what Shakespeare said about the quality of mercy. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. China today is not the China of 20 years ago. It is a mighty country full of success on many fronts, and it is justifiably proud of what has been achieved. It should shed its insecurity about June 4th and boldly face its history. To start the process of healing the country's deep wounds, I hope the Chinese government will temper justice with mercy and release those still serving sentences for what they did in the Tiananmen protests of 20 years ago. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John, for your sharing your insight and perspective and experience with us. We're now at the question and answer period of our program, and thank you all for the questions you've provided tonight. For a radio audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, How Tiananmen Changed China, with John Kam. He's the founder and executive director of the Dui Hua Foundation.
Hello, hello.
John, one question is, you mentioned the young man who was standing in front of the tanks, and one of our attendees would like to know, do we know what happened to him?
We don't. We had a name, Wang Weilin was the name that was out there. But a few years ago, the Los Angeles Times did a really solid investigation into who this man might be and who is this Wang Weilin. And the conclusion was that we simply don't know. Apparently, the name Wang Weilin was cooked up to throw the police off the scent of the real guy. And apparently it worked, because we don't know who the real guy is. And there is no Wang Weilin that we're aware of. So we don't know what happened. And I think that's emblematic, by the way, of Tiananmen. We really don't know, as I said in my remarks, I don't think we know 15% of the names of people who were actually detained. So even had he been detained, we probably still wouldn't know his name. It's just one of the realities of working in China in this area.
Given what you know about China and the events leading up to Tiananmen, what do you think the government's response should have been?
Well, I think they probably should have been a bit more patient. My understanding is that the students were already thinning in the ranks. As I've pointed out, today in China, you've got 100,000 mass incidents, okay? You have mass incidents in China that involve 10,000 people. There was one in Guizhou last year with 30,000 people. Now, occasionally there is some violence with these massive protests, but rarely. Most of them are settled without resort to violence. They're settled peaceably. That is a great legacy of Tiananmen, by the way. The Chinese government came away from that experience knowing that it could have handled things much, much differently. I think things went out of control. There was a lot of domestic political factors at work. Bad decisions were made. Mm-hmm. But on reflection, they should have been more patient and allowed the students to vacate the square. And by the way, it was coming to the end of the school year, and we all know that kids at the end of school years, you know, they head for home. And that's probably what would have happened.
What was Zhao Ziyang's view of all of this? I don't know if you've had a chance to read the journal. And he, again, was the former director of the Communist Party in China. What was his view of the Tiananmen Square?
Without wishing to, you know, I think if you read it, and I have read the book, you see that he was greatly troubled by efforts by a few people he calls hardliners to sway Deng Xiaoping in favor of a harsh crackdown. And Deng was ready to be persuaded. Deng Xiaoping had a lot of great attributes, but, you know, as Zhao says, it was always stability. It always boiled down to stability, perhaps because of his own experience in the Cultural Revolution, what he went through. So he was absolutely opposed to any kind of instability, protest, or demonstrations. And he allowed himself to be swayed by people like Li Peng, Deng Lijun, the mayor of Beijing, you know, people who had an interest in seeing that the protests were put down violently. But his own, you know, as he writes in the book, he knew the end had come. He would have to step down. He was being criticized. But as he said, I didn't want to go down in history as the general secretary of the party who ordered the killing of students.
Mm-hmm. What was the role in local governments in the crackdown?
A great question, and it sort of points to this point I've been trying to make. We know so little about how the protests were handled nationwide. In some areas, they were handled quite well. There's some controversy over Shanghai. There were large-scale arrests, there were some executions in Shanghai. There was a pretty well-known incident in which a train was stopped and set on fire. Aside from that, there were no violent protests in the city. And as you probably know, Jiang Zemin was secretary at the time of Shanghai, future president and chairman of the Communist Party. So Jiang Zemin was head party secretary in Shanghai during the protests, and Zhu Rongji was the mayor. And the story that is told is that, Zhu Rongji was told to go on local television and deliver a hard speech against the protesters. And the story is that he got to the studio and he didn't have his glasses. So he said, oh my goodness, I left my glasses at home, but we're about to go on air. So he couldn't read the speech he was given. And instead he gave a very conciliatory speech, which helped calm things down. So it was different all over the country. In some parts of the country, the local authorities handled it very well. Mm-hmm. In other parts of the country, they didn't. Xi'an comes to mind, Changsha, Chengdu. These were places where you really did have violent uprisings and very, very harsh repression and executions, mm-hmm. and plenty of arrests.
Now, we've referenced this book. Can you tell our audience the actual name of the, I think it's Prisoner of the State?
Yeah, Prisoner of the State is the memoir. It is available now both in English. Actually, it came out in English a week before the Chinese version. And it's available in Hong Kong in Chinese now. And it really is quite a popular read. People are really grabbing it. I wouldn't be surprised if it's already sold out. But Prisoner of the State is the name of the book.
Can you talk about some of the recent domestic changes or democratic changes in the area of local government in terms of elections and representation?
Well, for, local level elections have been taking place in China for quite some time, actually. Some of the early local election experiments were taking place in the 80s. Now we have village elections all over the country. They've had three village election laws. Most recently, there's been another amendment. But it seems to have kind of stuck a bit in a rut. Elections were supposed to move up towards township and county and above, but they've stayed at the level of the village. So we've seen a lot of action at the very local level, but democratic reform has not proceeded beyond the level of the villages.
How do you see, speaking of elected officials, Speaker Pelosi's visit to China, and do you think her visit can help China to improve, and her efforts, let's say, to improve China's human rights?
You may know that I first met the speaker at the first congressional hearings on China's most favored nation in 1990. I was taking the position that we should not, in fact, break the trade relationship. And we engaged in a very spirited debate. Mm-hmm. And we have over many years. I think she has adopted an approach that is quite different from mine. So, of course, I was delighted to see that she has, in fact, finally adopted my approach. And I have already commended her for that. I think I was quoted in the Congressional Quarterly today that perhaps I should declare victory and go home. But she's a different person. She speaks. She's a third-ranking official in the United States government. There are priorities, other priorities. She went to Beijing to try to move China in the direction of acceding to a new climate change agreement that's going to be negotiated in Copenhagen later this year. It's very, very important that we make progress in this area. But all that said, it still boils down to what works. If you're trying to help people in difficult situations, you don't necessarily help them by going into Tiananmen Square, unfolding a banner, and giving a bunch of press interviews. The methodology I have followed for 20 years is very different. And frankly, it's exactly what she did. You prepare yourself well. You put together a good list of names of people who can be helped. And you do not condemn the Chinese government in advance. You don't make fiery speeches at your hotel before heading off to see whoever it is you're seeing. But when you see whoever it is you are seeing, you bring up the cases. Now, she's done all of that. That's exactly what she did. She gave a list of 10 names. She just has told everybody who those 10 people are today. It's a pretty good list. Now it's time for follow-up, you see? Now it's time for the speaker to go to the Chinese ambassador or to have the American ambassador go to the foreign minister and say, okay, I came, I was quiet and respectful, I didn't embarrass you. What are you going to do for me? That's what works. Okay? That's what works. And I'm delighted, as I said, that the speaker has come around to adopting my approach. I hope this is broadcast.
Yeah. Why do you think the government is willing to see you?
Well, you know, the answer to that is probably, well, a bit complicated. Let me say that sometimes they don't see me. I mean, over 20 years, there have been times when, for various reasons, the Chinese government has declined to see me. What I do then is to let them know that I'll be back in a month or two. From 1995 to 1997, I went to Beijing 10 times, and no one would see me, except the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to deliver a lecture on why no one was seeing me. But, you know, the key, really, a key to success in China, in my opinion, in business, whether it's the business of human rights or selling chemicals, persistence. The number one attribute for a successful relationship with China is persistence. Just keep coming back, keep, you know, sticking to your principles, sticking to your cases. That's what works. But why do they see me? Well, they see me for different reasons at different times. When Jiang Zemin was coming to the United States for his final state visit in 2002, Jiang Zemin wanted something special. He wanted a special treatment at the Crawford Ranch. When I found out what he wanted, I spoke to some friends. It wasn't that difficult to arrange what he wanted. But in return, China released Awang Sangdrol, the youngest of the Drapchi nuns. And a very moving story. She probably knows. She went in at the age of 13. She was in prison for 10 years. And she was released. So in that case, you know, the main thing in dealing, I feel, with the Chinese government on this and other matters is find out what they want and then find out what they're prepared to do for it. That's just basic business sense. So I tried to do that in my dealings with China. Over the years, sometimes it's easier than others. But again, the key is persistence. I was there in March. I'll be there in June this month later. Just keep going back and keep trying.
Although protests have been allowed in Hong Kong, this guest writes, apparently several dissidents have been denied entry to Hong Kong last week.
Yes.
Has Hong Kong lost control over access from abroad in the mainland?
It's a very mixed picture. You had some dissidents who got in and others who were denied entry. And this is not just with respect to the June 4th protests. There have been a number of instances where the Immigration Department refused entry to people who are apparently on some kind of a list. But not all. Some do get through. Xiong Yen was one of the leading student protesters. He is addressing the big candle light rally that starts in a few hours. So, you know, some people are allowed in and others aren't. We also have this very interesting situation in Macau now, where Macau is actually stopping people from entering from Hong Kong, Hong Kong Legislative Council members. This is causing quite a stir and has involved, the Hong Kong government appealing to the Chinese government to get the Macau authorities to allow Hong Kong members of the Legislative Council. These are not, maybe not all of them, but these are not by and large radical, wild-eyed people. They're legislators. But they, too, are on a list of some sort. So what we're seeing is not only in Hong Kong but in Macau and, of course, on the mainland, there is a tightening up of access to people who are seen as threats. Sound familiar? Look, I had a friend in New York who showed me his passport, and he had a Chinese visa in his passport. But then when he went to go back in, he's been very outspoken on Tibet. He gave his passport to the Chinese consulate, and back came the passport with a big red stamp opposite the first page. And basically it said, this man is not to be allowed into China. So he showed me this, and I said, John, that's terrible. He says, that's what we do in the United States. If you go to an American consulate overseas, and for some reason they don't want to let you into the country, they put a stamp in your passport, and you cannot enter.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the Chinese public's attitude is toward capital punishment?
Oh, again, very interesting. One of the fascinating things about capital punishment in China is how closely public opinion mirrors public opinion here. To the extent that we can take polls, a majority of the Chinese people support capital punishment, and a majority of Americans support capital punishment. Now, of course, there are big differences in the way that capital punishment is carried out. But by and large, support for capital punishment is strong in China. But just as here, there is no support for executing people recklessly, and there is certainly no support for executing people who might be innocent of the crime. And that's where the rubber has traditionally met the road. Now, in this country, the abolitionist movement is still looking to find that one incontrovertible case of someone who has been executed wrongly. Unless I'm mistaken, that case has yet to be discovered or publicized. There are doubtless such cases, but we haven't managed to find one yet. And the reason why, of course, this is so important is if you look at the history of abolition in other countries, always, almost always, abolition follows a case of someone who's been wrongfully executed. You know, as the old saying goes, better spare 100 guilty people than to execute one wrongly. So we, you know, we are looking for that case here in this country. In China, as you might know, that in fact there have been such cases, and they've already been publicized. And it's quite an interesting situation. Now, obviously, in those cases where someone has been wrongfully executed, there is tremendous public unhappiness, but it hasn't extended yet to a national level of opposing the death penalty. But as I said in my speech, really one of the things that the Chinese government has done and that Hu Jintao has overseen, for which they have gotten almost no credit, is that they have reduced the number of executions by a huge number. At the end of the 1990s, we reckon about 15,000 people were being executed every year. Now it's between 5,000 and 6,000. That's still too many. It's still a horror. But I'm not one of those people who thinks that 15,000 executions is the same as 5,000, any more than I think that 50 executions is the same as 5,000. All right? And that's where we are in China. The number's coming down, but abolition is years away, as it probably is in this country.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Gallup polls of U.S. attitudes towards China. Mm-hmm. What is the Chinese attitude toward the U.S.?
That's also a great question. And it's coming down. The most recent Pew poll shows a pretty sharp drop in the Chinese people's impressions of the United States. So this is a matter, I think, for our policymakers in both capitals to pay attention to. We now have a situation where each country is viewed negatively in the other country, and that's never happened before. So you've got populations out there who are increasingly distrustful of the other country and who don't like the other country. And as I said, this is something new, and it's dangerous, and the policymakers should pay attention to this, because you're not ultimately going to have a good relationship between the two countries if the two people don't trust and like each other. So we have to do something about that. So actually, the approval rating of the United States and China is roughly as low as the approval rating of China is in the United States.
We've heard a lot about the student movement, but what about the workers' movement? And I'd like to ask also, in light of this recession, and I think there's something like 20 million Chinese who have lost their jobs in the cities who have returned to the rural areas, how is that affecting the social fabric of China?
We don't know yet. The number of 20 million migrants who have lost their jobs probably is on the low side. I have heard of an internal study by the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences that puts the number closer to 50 million. Now, what we're talking about here is a population of between 200 and 300 million migrant workers. So if it's 20 million, it's 10%. If it's 50, it's 20, 30%. It's a big number. But it's diffuse in the sense that the migrants come from many different parts of China. So it's not as though, you know, all 20 million lost their jobs, they come from Sichuan. They're spread out around the country. And here's where, again, the stimulus package that the Chinese government has introduced is, you know, is directed to trying to deal with some of these issues. There will be and have been cash handouts. By the way, as was the case with the Sichuan earthquake, the Chinese government adopted certain policies. Suspended the one child per family, obviously, paid the bereaved, I think, 60,000 renminbi. None of this is meant to diminish in any way the horror of what happened. But it is all of this new way of dealing with discontent that I've been referring to. The Chinese government learned some things from what happened 20 years ago. they have opted for a softer approach. And in this case, in terms of workers, as I mentioned, they've got a new labor law, a labor contract law. It does increase protections for workers. You've got actually a budding legal system. I know of people who are suing employers for violations of the labor law. There are lawyers in China who are defending workers and sometimes winning. This is a very positive development. I'm sorry to say, though, my old unit, the American Chamber of Commerce, came out in opposition to the labor law on the grounds that this would increase costs of American business in China. So we haven't had the best record, I think, as business people promoting human rights.
Thank you all again for your questions. We have time, I think, for one more. Do you feel that the Chinese people want to move on to speaking about economic prosperity and perhaps these issues of human rights and democratic reforms are not as high a priority as they were 20 years ago?
Well, what I think is that as people become wealthier, as they travel more, as more and more technology becomes available to them, they will show an interest in their history. You know, the Chinese people their histories go back thousands of years. I'm sure you know that. This is a nation of historians. They care deeply about history. You know, every family has their own genealogy. Every family keeps a history. It's not like in this country where genealogy is a kind of a hobby. In China, you know, you name people in your family based on your genealogy. You can go back and you can trace the history of your family for generations. So this is a people that puts great store in history. So I think actually as China moves forward, which it will, and becomes wealthier and more powerful, instead of turning its back on the past, China will come to terms with the past. Sooner rather than later, I think we all hope. Well, thank you again, if that's the last question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to John Kam, founder and executive director of the Dui Hua Foundation. Again, our thanks to the Asia Society of Northern California for their support of tonight's program, and thank all of you for being here, for your questions, and thank you again to our radio audience. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.
And thank you.